I guess one kind of, again, question that's more about the social aspects or the whatever aspects of, this is how you were supporting yourself. Scholarship, parents,
the parents.
Loans.
No, my father, from, you know, from the day all of us were born, he saved enough money that we could go to college. He paid, you know, he saved the money so we could pay for it outright. Mm-hmm. And there was and money for a graduate school. Mm-hmm. He had enough that we could all do that. He dedicated his entire, you know, career from the day we were born to make sure that he saved for that mm-hmm. event, for those events. So we didn't have to pay anything. Mm-hmm. And we were lucky because it was right before. When I went to medical school, it cost $4,000 or $5,000 a year. And then within 2 years after I graduated, it was $12,000 a year. So that it really, I really just got in before it was necessary to
sell your soul.
Yeah. I mean, almost, we would have had to have taken out loans and things. It's kind of crazy. But mm-hmm. I just came in just a little bit before that, so I'm real lucky mm-hmm. from that point of view.
I wonder if it's affected much how or who becomes an MD nowadays, and whether it's changed how medicine is practiced, not only taught. I don't know. It's a question we can talk about later. We talk more about the more general things related to being a doctor or something like that. I really know very little about, you know, how one goes about deciding where one's going to go after that for a residency or, I guess, internships or however it's, which comes before which, and whether there's exams beyond, you know, passing classes or getting graded in classes. And I know there's boards and things that come later with more training in specific fields and then in general. I guess the way to ask a question or ask the question about this is, again, how did you end up where you ended up, which is at Philadelphia Children's Hospital? Or maybe I'm skipping a whole thing you want to talk about, for instance, finishing med school or
not really
picking a specialty. Or
medical is really fun, but I had already decided about pediatrics, and yeah. everything I did, you know, reaffirmed that during mm-hmm. medical school. So I knew I wanted to go to a really good program. And I had some, I don't know how I had an awareness, but I knew which were the good children's hospitals. And I had advisors as well mm-hmm. in school that would help me figure that out. But during my fourth year of med school, I went to, I did electives at three different children's hospitals. Two of them were in Philadelphia. I did an elective in renal, in nephrology, at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, which is where I had been working in the playroom years all before. Right. And I did that because I knew I had a connection with that hospital, that I thought it was a really neat place, and I wanted to go there, spend a month there, let the people there get to know me, mm-hmm. and then apply there for residency. And I also did a month at Children's Hospital Philadelphia. I did 2 months together in Philadelphia, and I stayed, you know, there for it. And at Children's Hospital Philadelphia, which is called CHOP, everybody calls it CHOP, I did an infectious disease elective. And I also, somewhere early in my fourth year, went to New York for a month to Bellevue Hospital. Mm-hmm. And I worked on their pediatrics ward. And I don't even know why I went there. I have no idea. I don't think I had any intention of going there for residency. I did apply there for residency, I'm pretty sure, but it wasn't my intention. I think I wanted to go there just because I wanted to get the most radical inner city mm-hmm. Pediatric experience that I could. I was really interested. Well, of course, I knew many of the kids mm-hmm. in New York from Camp Oakhurst, and it gave me an opportunity to be with some of my friends from Camp Oakhurst, and that may have had something to do with it, but I don't know. I heard Bellevue was City Hospital, mm-hmm. I just said, well, I'm just going to go there and enjoy myself and see some real, inner city mm-hmm. healthcare problems. And that's exactly what happened there. You know, it was really wild, really, really wild type of medical, you know, environment, just because, you know, we're talking about patients that, you know, have no support system, mm-hmm. Come from really bad families, and so forth, and come in the hospital and with various problems, and And I got the experience of seeing how to deal with that situation.
It's not something you decided to go into in a kind of a permanent way, though, right? I don't know who you're serving here, for instance, in Chicago. I mean, I'm staying over at near Rush Presbyterian and Cook County, and I assume that that's probably the places in Chicago where those kinds of...
This is the same.
Yeah.
Down here is the same. University of Chicago provides, dollar-wise, more charity care than any other hospital in the city.
Okay.
It's the same. Mm-hmm. We're the same as Cook County and U of I. We're not as... I mean, Cook County is a county hospital, so, you know, it's real radical there. But, you know, it's the same. We're in a very tiny little island that's in, you know...
Right. No, I've noticed as I've come down here.
Ghetto areas.
Right. Okay.
And in addition to that, people come here from all over the world for specialized stuff. But it's pretty much the same.
Also at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, and I would assume not so much in Minnesota, but perhaps I'm just not aware of what goes on at University of Minnesota.
Not so much in Minnesota. Yeah. Minnesota was more, poor people coming from rural areas. Into the city for treatment for cancer.
Okay. So what? Again, you say you applied to Bellevue for residency. You applied to obviously Children's Hospital in Philly.
So I had some experiences in my fourth year, which helped me decide where I wanted to go. And it was clear, it was obvious to me that Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was where I wanted to go. Mm. And so I went through the ranking business, and I ranked all my hospitals. And Children's Hospital Fellows was my first choice, and that's what I got into.
Okay.
So.
Again, I'd already asked you about academic medicine, and you kind of decided, you know, you would that you were leaning toward that. That was something that interested you, rather than just being a GP or a pediatrician with a practice in Deal or something like that. When did you become interested? I know from your CV that I'm trying to place your first publication, and I think it perhaps dates back to Philly, but I'm not necessarily that sure about it. If I can find it. You were in Minnesota by 85. I'm sorry, you were there by 82, weren't you?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering when you're interested in kind of pursuing the... I guess some of the prerequisites of being an academic MD, which is to publish, which is to conduct some sort of research, not necessarily kind of but molecular biological research, but epidemiological research, those sorts of things.
Right.
When you got interested in it, was that at Philly, or does one not have time for that when one does residency? Or is that something that's supposed to come later? Again, I'm very vague on how all these things...
Some people do it earlier, but yeah, usually you do it later. Mm-hmm. You're too busy in your residency to do it.
Okay.
But in the beginning at Children's Hospital, I was thinking, well, gee, I'd like to do primary care for inner city poor people, okay? Or I wanted to take care of handicapped kids because of my experience at Camp Oakers. Or I don't know what. And in my first year, in October of my first year at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was when I went through the oncology ward. And that changed what I was going to do, mm-hmm. because I sort of forgot about the kids with handicaps, and I thought that these kids were just incredible. People say about kids, you know, like that have cancer, that they seem a little bit precocious. They, you know, gone through all this stuff. Mm-hmm. They know about all these fancy words, chemotherapy, and the names of their drugs, and the names of all their different complications, and they know a lot about medicine and things like that. And they're just tiny little kids, and but they're really neat. They're really interesting kids because the way they've adapted to their situation. And I was very attracted to the patients, and that started me on the road to deciding that I wanted to go into oncology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just went through the 3-year program in Philadelphia, and I decided that I did want to that I did want to pursue that. And I just decided, well, I got to do something. I got to pick something. I can either pick handicappers or oncology, or I can say I'm going to, you know, go into some kind of primary care in the inner city or whatever. And I just said, well, I really liked my experience on the oncology board. I think I'm going to go ahead and study that subspecialty.
Okay. And that's what does when out of residency, you're really required to cover all the areas. In other words, that's some sort of rotational situation. Okay. And perhaps maybe the last year of your residency can be in this area that you're more particularly interested in. I don't know how that works as well, but
no,
it's all split evenly among whatever the rotations, however many there are, probably six or something like that, right? Or maybe just three. I don't know.
There's a lot of different rotations.
It's like 100 then.
Like 12, because there's 12 months. I mean, but you work in the emergency room, which is seeing everything.
Right.
You work in intensive care, which is seeing everything. You work on oncology, which is special. And then in that particular hospital, the rest of the different areas were just divided up by age. So you work with a little, you work with newborns, you work with preemies, you work with babies, you work with middle, you know, regular little kids and adolescents, and there's a ward for adolescents. So you rotate through all the different ages, but you see all the different diseases. Mm-hmm. Oncology is, in particular, different because many hospitals have that as a separate ward.
For you mean pediatric oncology, not just oncology? And, you know, I mean, that's also then yet another. So okay.
So
is that how they did it?
Exposed to everything.
Is that how they did it at Children's Hospital? Was to had they had a separate oncology ward? Did, regardless of age or something like that,
regardless of age.
I've noticed that in the literature of yours, and I guess the citation of others, that childhood cancers are treated pretty much as a group. In other words, it up until adolescence, and even up, I guess, until 18, 19 years old in some cases. Mm-hmm. But maybe I don't know if this is the place to ask such a question, because again, this we're now moving into an area in which, you know, my background is quite slim, and I just hope that in my asking questions, which may seem basic to you, that you're willing to answer them, because people will also be able to get a sense of how someone who's a specialist in a field is can explain and make someone who's a complete non-specialist in the field, you know, understand, and will give people who come back and read this many years from now an idea of your view on things at this particular time and with a particular work you've done. What specifics are there involved in, you know, in separating out childhood cancers from adult cancer? What are some of the, I don't know, criteria for or reasons for doing that and treating it as a different area, let's say? And not all the time, I realize, but
I don't know. I mean, pediatricians and pediatric subspecialists take care of children, and internists and internal medicine subspecialists take care of adults.
Okay. So you just think it's a matter of just how things in medicine have developed generally. I guess what I'm asking is, do you find that you really need a different kind of knowledge and have a different kind of experience as somebody who treats children who have cancer as opposed to somebody who would be treating adults who have cancer?
Yeah. Well, you and just have to know. I mean, you just have to know.
Kids are different.
Kids are different sizes. There's differences in, as they develop in terms of their metabolism and everything.
Okay.
And there's not a single cancer that kids get that adults get. I mean, this is a totally different field, except for leukemia. Kids and adults get leukemia, but otherwise, basically, everything's totally different.
Totally, okay.
I mean, adults get breast cancer and colon cancer and ovarian cancer. Kids never get breast cancer, colon cancer, or ovarian cancer. Kids get Wilms tumor, which is a kidney, and retinoblastoma, which is of the eye, and neuroblastoma, which is of the nervous system, and no adults ever get any of those cancers.
And that's mainly because their nervous system is pretty much developed, and the cells are not in the process of changing, and therefore not as capable as being transformed. I mean, is this why there's see that? And yet there are other kinds of changes, and
Nobody really knows, but. There's probably some cells that are in children that aren't there anymore in adults. Cells that are susceptible to becoming malignant.
Because they are.
By the time they're adults, most of the cells have gone away. They're just vestiges from embryonic life.
Or they're set in their ways, and they won't be changing or dividing or acting as the source for other newer cells.
Okay. So it's a different field, but that's true for all. I mean, it's true for all the subspecialties. You know, pediatric, pulmonary people take care of children with lung disease, and then internal medicine, pulmonary people take care of adults with pulmonary disease. And the same thing's true for all the subspecialties. Basically, it's just, you know, divided.
And certainly for cancer, it's not an issue of convenience or, okay, you know, you treat little kids, because maybe also you have some training in how to deal with little kids. It has to do with their bodies and and the vast differences, I guess. Because I, you know, as a layperson, I think of, well, somebody, a child, an infant who's 6 months is going to be radically different from a child of eight, as opposed to, I mean, I look at then an 8-year-old from, let's say, a 35-year-old, and I guess I'm wrong. I mean, that's just a common sense thing that's not very sensible, I guess. So, okay. What were you, you made your decision, you know, at Children's Hospital to kind of specialize in childhood cancers, and maybe we can even be more specific. You'd even, you know, kind of narrowed in on which kind of cancers you were interested in or something like that. How much did you learn there that, as a resident, you know, that you were going to, or could you apply to, you know, again, more the research end, or the, you know, that you were going to then pursue, or is that part of the decision-making process that you had then?
I didn't have any interest. I didn't really even have any interest in research.
Okay.
There wasn't anything about it. I just had the approach that I enjoyed taking care of these kids, and I enjoyed got satisfaction out of taking care of the problems that they had.
So your experience in the oncology rotation, the pediatric oncology rotation, or it's probably called hematology oncology, right? At Children's Hospital didn't prepare you or didn't make you see that there were certain areas that you definitely wanted to tackle when you went on to the next chapter of your life, that sort of thing. And for instance, ending up in Minnesota was the decision to go there was made for other reasons. Then there's somebody there doing this kind of research on childhood leukemia or something like that.
Yeah, that wasn't really the reason. I knew that I'd have to do research as part of my training if I was going to go into oncology. Part of the training program is that you do some research. And it sounded like fine. You know, it sounded like a good idea. It's part of the training. They're telling me that's what you're supposed to do. It sounded fine to me. But I didn't have any particular, you know, set goal that I wanted to discover the cure for cancer or discover the cure for a particular cancer or try to understand anything. I just wanted to learn how to take care of these patients.
Okay.
That's all. I knew that I was going to be doing some other stuff, and it sounded kind of interesting to me. But that wasn't what I wanted, and I wasn't.
Before we move on to kind of Minnesota, is there anything else? Again, I don't like to close things off before. You know, you've had a chance to maybe talk more about Children's Hospital or, you know, again, any particular. We've also tended to neglect completely any aspect of a social life you might have. I know with your wife that you almost certainly have met her here in the Chicago area and only been married, let's say, 3 or 4 years. So that's, I'm not jumping, you know, I'm not missing something in that sense. But again, were you just basically being a med student and then being a resident for these, we've covered, I think, 7 years without really talking about whether you were able to go surfing at all or, you know.
Well, it's
something that happened in your family's, you know, history or life that, you know, was of earth-shattering importance or something.
Not
like
really
that.
Nothing happened in the family at that point. The residency was, you know, even better than med school. I mean, now we had it down to 20 people in my class, and getting to know them, and we really got along really well. We had a great group. I don't know, like 5 or 6 of us rented a house in Avalon, New Jersey, every summer, and we would drive down there on our weekends off, and that was, you know, really fun.
It's a great place, cooler by a mile.
Right.
We used to go there spring breaks when it was colder by a mile.
Yeah. So you know, that we had a lot of fun down there. We had a great group. I'm very close with several people from my residency, you know, to this day.
Well, what are they doing? And maybe you can even mention their names, but you know what?
Well, Doreen, who I mentioned before, Doreen Morrow, I met on the first day of college at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so we were friends throughout college. And then she went to a different medical school than I did. She went to Hershey Medical School. And then she went to a different pediatric residency program than I did at Baylor in Houston, Texas. And in her first year of her residency, her mother was dying of breast cancer. And she decided that she wanted to get closer back to her mother. And I had been talking to her, and I told her that there was going to be an opening at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia for the second year of the residency, because one of the people that we had was leaving unexpectedly. And so, and I told my superiors about her, and that she was a great person, and that we should get her to fill this place because she wants to be here. And and of course she knew Philadelphia.
Right.
And so she got that job, and she came up. And so the second 2 years of the residency, I was back together with Doreen again. And so we've been friends all along. But also the people that I met in the residency program included Andrew Castorino, who I was the best man in his wedding exactly 1 year ago.
Oh, okay.
And Mike Spear, who's now... But Drew Castorino is still in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's in the intensive care program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
And is that an academic, affiliation with Penn as well?
Yeah.
That he has, okay.
Yeah. And just a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. Mike Spear is the other close friend who... is a neonatologist in Wilmington, Delaware. And then a lot of other miscellaneous people. Yeah. But those two guys I keep up with very closely, and Doreen I keep up with very close.
Okay.
So that was, socially it was a great, great 3 years. There's always a girlfriend here and there. Well, I don't know what to say. I did have
Of your first love, and it ended tragically. Who knows? There could be a great soap opera in here, or it's just something nice and kind you want to say about somebody or something. I don't know. It doesn't always have to have something to do with medicine and research. This is a life, kind of what we call a modified life biography. So if there's, somebody special you want to talk about, or somebody you especially want to avoid because your wife is going to be reading this, then we'll move on. I do have a note from you. Again, you were the first to actually send me a list of things that I should remind you of, and I don't know if I've been very good about it. Dougie at Children's Hospital, and I don't know if that's a patient or a...
Yeah, he was a patient on the oncology ward. I don't know that I really need to talk about him.
Okay.
He was a really cute little 3-year-old whose parents never came around to see him. So
Let's turn this off for a second. Okay. You don't want to talk, you don't want to go into... now you've got my curiosity piqued. Why did you bring him up in a list, send him his name to me in a list of things?
Well, he's just one of the cute little kids on the oncology ward that, I was spent a lot of time with. And, learned how to deal with his disease and learned how to deal with the fact that he had to get needles stuck in him all the time. And he became very friendly with the staff that were there. And I don't really know how to put it into words. He's just somebody that I remember very clearly who affected my decision to go into oncology. But he was just a 3-year-old little boy who I spent a lot of time with. And, my interest was just because these kids were so cute, more than because I wanted to make a medical breakthrough or something like that. That's how I got into it.
I don't know, maybe this is something it occurred to me, and I don't know that it's something you want to pursue, but now you have your own family, and again, this is a recent thing, and I assume that in many ways people in your situation, MDs, tend to maybe start families earlier. I know they start them perhaps later than most people because of the immense amount of intense work that's required, and the difficulties in doing that with a family. We've already kind of talked about the issues now as they face you at this stage of the game, and we will talk about them later. But do you see any correlation between your work, which is with children who are sick, and either one perhaps not having a family or not settling down earlier than might be expected? Perhaps I'm being really, out of line. Suggesting that somebody has you're supposed to have done this by a certain time or something like that.
You mean if I had a family, I wouldn't have gotten so close with Dougie? Is that what you're saying?
No, or the other way around, because, you know, you really had... I'm just curious as to or how you look at your own children now. Again, you have three daughters, but one is a stepdaughter, and the other two, one's 1 year old and one's two. And I'm just curious. Here's your life in dealing with very sick children, and here you have your own children. I'm just wondering whether you're aware of, you know, most fathers, I don't think, probably have these kinds of connections or other things going on in their life that makes them so aware of children, and how maybe susceptible they are to harm and things like that or something. So I'm just curious as to how maybe you feel about your own children now, or about or an explanation as to why maybe it's come at this point in your life as opposed to earlier. Or is this just all mumbo jumbo to you, what I'm driving at?
I don't know. I got married. I don't know.
You just met the right person, and that's the right woman, and that's what happened. And
I guess.
And it doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with your work and.
Might be that I was, you know, I felt like I wanted to make sure that I was going through my training fully, and I didn't. No, I wasn't never able to make a full commitment to getting married in the middle of that. I really don't know.
Yeah. I may be reading my own kind of fears about, you know, having children or something with the situation of constantly being and seeing and being with children who are very sick. I mean, I guess I would just... Since, I would put two and two together and, you know, be very wary, I think. I don't know, maybe. But again, maybe that's... injecting myself into somebody else's life as opposed to...
it's not a big thing for me.
No.
I'm really relaxed about their medical situation. If anything's wrong with them, they go to some doc, and then they go to a pediatrician.
Right. And you don't interfere in that part of it or whatever. That's not your area or something like that. Except as a father, not as a doctor, right?
Yeah, I don't know why some people might get really anxious about their children's health, but because they know so much about children that are sick, but I don't feel that way.
I suppose that's probably not a common thing among doctors. No, I mean, there are plenty of doctors with families. So.
Yeah, I think you just block stuff out and have a lot of little defense mechanisms to block it out, so you don't think about it too much. Every once in a while, it invades your consciousness, but most of the time, I'm pretty relaxed about it. I'm not really overly concerned that they're all going to get leukemia. Or just every once in a while you think about things like that, but it doesn't affect.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of thinking that here I am doing all these oral histories, and you'll never get me on the other side of the microphone. That sort of thing is, I guess, what I'm wondering about, and wondering about your feelings concerning that. But as you said, and maybe the best and easiest answer is that, well, you know, you separate the two out. And, that you have so that set up so that you can be the father and also, you know, again, be the professional. All right. Is there anything, again, I think we covered even the part that you wanted to about, you know, or you asked me to remind you of in Philadelphia, and I guess I would just go on to ask, you know, how it came about that you ended up at Minnesota for your next, I guess your title was clinical fellow. I don't know, this is called an internship or something along those lines?
No. The internship, I didn't take it. An internship usually means that you're rotating through all the different areas of medicine, like surgery and medicine.
So that's before residency.
Yeah, but I didn't take an internship because I knew I wanted to go to pediatrics, so I just did a pediatric residency, and you don't have to take internships anymore. And then after that, your subspecialty training is called a fellowship. That was what that was. I was taking the subspecialty pediatric hematology and oncology fellowship, which was a 3-year.
And why at Minnesota, just... Again, good program.
I always, you know, want to be in the best program. You know.
So that doesn't matter where it is or who it is.
And not that Tufts was the best medical school in the country, but it was certainly good. But I wanted to be the best pediatric program, and then for hematology, I wanted to be in the best training program. I heard a lot about them, you know, from my few advisors that I had. You know, it was one of the few, you know, one of the four places that I looked at.
What were some of the other places? Do you recall what some of the other good programs were?
Seattle. It's called Children's Orthopedic Hospital, Seattle. Indiana University. University of Minnesota. And I know I went somewhere else. I didn't want to stay in Philadelphia for that because I didn't like... I wasn't really that happy with the people that were in the oncology section, and some things were changing there, and so it just didn't seem like a very set.
What were some of the problems you had with it? I mean, what were some of you, again, not to name names and say, oh, that person, I didn't like them. Were these personal problems, or were they problems about how they were going about treatment, or?
No, I didn't like their personalities. Okay. They really didn't pay a lot of attention to me, so it wasn't like they were welcoming into, they didn't seem like a very welcoming group to me at the time, and the people that I did know that were sort of my friends were the people that were in training there, and they didn't seem very happy with the way things were going for them. It was a great place for the patients, but it didn't seem like a good place to train in oncology. It didn't seem like the faculty there were really very together at that moment in time.
You mean together in being good trainers, as yeah. opposed to, I mean, as you said, then perhaps the patients, the children who were there were getting very good care. I take it Philadelphia was, I mean, Children's Hospital was one of the, you know, you said you looked at the kind of the four best, or you looked at, you know, four places that were really top of the line, but Philly would have been another place as well.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't interview there. I didn't ask.
You didn't even write, right? And what about here? Was somebody like Janet Raleigh wasn't here at the time?
Okay. I had no clue. I didn't even know what the University of Chicago was.
Okay.
If you live in the East, you don't know the University of Chicago. If you live anywhere else, the University of Chicago is famous. It's incredible. It's
well,
one of the top
yeah,
schools.
No, it
it's
is.
It's a top school, but I never heard of it. I had no clue about the University of Chicago. I don't know how that escaped me.
Well, maybe since they're back east, maybe if we say Ivy League, then maybe you haven't heard of the University of Chicago. For those of us on the Ivy League, some awareness. Maybe more in philosophy and economics and that sort of thing. But I don't know anything about good medical schools versus bad and that sort of thing anyway. Yeah. So.
Yeah. But, I applied to a few places, and I just liked the people in Minnesota. They were just great. The day that I interviewed, they just were really excited about what they were doing, and they were excited about me, and they were excited about the opportunities there for taking care of patients and for research. They also had one of the best bone marrow transplant was becoming very, very important. It is very, very important now in taking care of oncology patients, and they really had, they definitely did have the best children's bone marrow transplant program in the country. And so I guess that was probably one of the critical things, that I would have the opportunity to train with those people.
Okay. And did this pan out? I mean, this is what one of the things that you did when you went there was to learn these techniques, I guess, or...
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the question to ask would be what exactly were some of your duties or responsibilities, and what were some of your activities in this fellowship? Where you're now kind of, you know, it's just the one thing, and then for 3 years, and then you finally, after what, a half a century, you can now settle down and do one thing, as opposed to constantly moving through and learning this and applying that.
Well, there was clinical and research training that was part of the fellowship, and both were required. And so you start out doing clinical for the first year, and then the second year you start getting into some kind of research project, as well as do some clinical, and then in the last year you pretty much concentrate on your research. So I went through the clinical training, and I got interested in cytogenetics during that time, because chromosome abnormalities and cancer were becoming a really, really big area. The ability to study those chromosome abnormalities with molecular biology techniques was at its heyday. There was a woman there who happened to be a pediatric oncologist as well as a cytogeneticist, whose name was Diane Arthur. So I just decided, plus I had a background with genetics because I had studied, I had this little experience with Dr. Lupin when I was in undergraduate, and I worked with this Dr. Melman when I was doing these cell culture techniques, and he was a geneticist. So I had this sort of background with it. And for some reason it was appealing to me to go to her lab and study, learn how to analyze chromosomes and to do some projects related to leukemia. And so that's what I did, and I ended up doing 3 or 4 projects while I was there, and writing papers, and I thought it was real interesting. But at the end of the 3 years, I knew I really couldn't be an independent researcher. I just didn't have enough training in the lab.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean independent? You mean being able to set up your own lab and really be a research MD as opposed to somebody who is seeing patients and doing clinical work?
Yeah, I knew I couldn't do that, so.
Would it have been, if you thought you had concentrated more on the research side, although given the the step-by-step process of getting an MD. Without going into I guess it's an MD-PhD program that one would need to go into or something at an earlier stage of the game, or in other words, how is somebody, let's say, like Janet Rowley, just because I know her name, or Diane, I forget her
Arthur.
Name. Arthur.
They just trained themselves. They didn't take any PhD program.
So
they
don't have
they just trained themselves. They're particularly brilliant people, which is one way of doing it.
To be particularly brilliant? Okay. It certainly seems to be one way. I don't know that I discount your talents as a...
But at the end of the 3 years, I didn't think that I could get grants and do it. So I had a choice: either I go into take a clinical job, or to do some more research training. And I thought I was getting pretty interested in the research. That was really growing on me. I really there were a lot of things I wanted to do. I thought I'd at least try it for a while longer and see how it would go. So I decided, well, let's pick the best place that I can think of, and that was to come here to Janet Rowley's program. And spend 2 years there and really solidify my ability to do the chromosome analysis and to learn some molecular biology techniques and to see what I could do, see what I could find out.
I guess I'd like to get into quite a bit of it. And to treat the 2 years at Minnesota, or I guess it's more three, excuse me, and the 2 years at 2 years here as a fellow, kind of together as a unit. Perhaps it's not the best thing, but I think perhaps some of the research work you did at Minnesota was continued here, or at least there was an extension of it. And you said you had kind of worked on four projects at. Minnesota. I don't know if we can cover them all in the same sort of detail, but you did give me one article from that time to read that's more of one of these kind of retrospective analyses study. Retrospective analysis, singular, studies, plural there, I've got it out. And then also I think the beginning of this, again, the first, at least, where you're an author on a paper about some chromosome studies and so on. What were the, you said four projects, maybe that's the place to start. What were the, how would you, divide them up or say what the four projects were that you were working on at Minnesota?
They sort of handed me one project, which was, which really became a long-term interest in some ways. And that was, before I even had gone there, they had decided to do some chromosome studies of children who had survived their leukemia and were several years down the line, and they were off their chemotherapy, to see if they could, make some assessment of how much chromosome damage they had as a result of their therapy. Because the big concern as these kids started being cured of cancer was, well, what have we done to them that's now going to affect them later in life? Are they going to all get cancer again from the chemotherapy that we gave them? Are they going to all be retarded? Are they going to all not be short? Are they all going to never develop any sexual characteristics? Are they all going to be psychologically damaged? All the late long-term effects, it was becoming important to know about those. Mm-hmm. And people in Minnesota had an interest in that. So one of the little things they did was they looked at did some chromosome studies on the blood of these survivors, and they found a fair number of sort of chromosome rearrangements and abnormalities. The significance of them wasn't known, but at least they just knew that they had some sustained chromosome damage.
And that, in some cases, right, in a few of the patients, they were able to. They had looked at blood samples or had been able to suggest that those abnormalities were definitely the result of chemo and maybe even radiotherapy, but not existent at the first diagnosis of the primary diagnosis, I guess is the more correct way of putting it. Okay.
Yeah, and so they only studied 10 patients, but it was one of the few studies that was like that. And so I went back, I came in several years later, and I went and I gathered up the same 10 patients and begged them for blood samples so that we could look again at the same patients to see if have all these things just gone away, have they gotten worse, are there more of these abnormalities, or whatever. And it turned out that it was about the same, you know, it wasn't really very much. But again, it was interesting just because there really wasn't any longitudinal study of these patients before. Mm-hmm. But it got me interested in mm-hmm. to a certain extent, in patients that went on to develop actually second malignancies. Well, that was the big concern.
We are kind of getting to the end of the table, but why don't we just go until we kind of just have to stop off, even if it's in the middle of a sentence, and we'll pick up on Monday morning with it. I guess my understanding of the situation is that certainly because of work that had been done on radiation and trying to understand X-ray effects before, during, and after on the development of nuclear weapons, and then, of course, the use of it in medicine from way before, and X-rays, that the medical community was already pretty aware of that, of the potential harm, or, yeah, especially when used over the long term. And as a matter of fact, it's the harm in the studying the harm that I think led to notions that we can cure or we can retard the development of things like cancer with this treatment. But I guess I'm still kind of, as a layperson, I read these articles, and as you said, Minnesota, people in Minnesota have become extremely concerned with the long-term effects of this kind of chemo and radiotherapy, and the long-term effects seem to be that, sure enough, down the road, in enough cases, and of course it's not 100%, I think I recall somewhere in one particular study of people of children later on, it's 28% or 30% coming up with a secondary neoplasm. That seems rather high, and that treatment this way. I wonder about the balance between primary, you know, the treatment at the primary diagnosis, and what the doctors and medical people expected to be got out of the treatment that, sure enough, down the line is going to lead to something, and again, maybe.
Well, it wasn't
fatal.
Well, it wasn't known. It wasn't known how high it was going to be. It wasn't 20. It's not 20 to 30% in any study.
In any. Okay.
In kids, it's more like 2%, 3% turned out, which isn't too bad. But still, people are really concerned about it. And as people are living longer, we're learning more about it right now. So there is a big concern about it. And plus, in Minnesota, with the bone marrow transplant, we were giving patients total body irradiation. Their whole body was irradiated in preparation for the bone marrow transplant, so that added to the whole concern. And so that was sort of the second study that I did. We did skin biopsies on patients who received total body irradiation, and we showed that the amount of chromosome damage in their skin was phenomenal. It was unbelievable. And the patients were fine, but at least at the moment, but it gave us a great concern for what might happen later.
We are going to take...